that I do this morning is to thank the Country Music Association for hosting the 1983 ARS Conference. Also, for making the recordings available with a sound next to unbelievable for 78 RPM shellac records made nearly 50 years ago. Danny Hatcher, Bob Pinson, and engineer Alan Stoker deserve my deep appreciation for making my portion of this conference possible. Each of you have received a list of the songs that we're going to play segments of today. I thought you'd find it more interesting if you knew who it was you were listening to rather than to just hear unknown artists in many cases. It's not an apology, but a fact that research into country music, politics, and public opinion is not your typical research project. Along the way in my research, I was often reminded of the adage, if you want to keep your friends, don't talk about politics or religion. So for a short while, we're going to have to overlook the wisdom of staying away from politics and religion in the hope that even if our new information doesn't fit neatly with all that we've always believed, we can still remain friends. I hope that this brief work on American country music, politics, and public opinion will serve as a starting point for a deeper look by researchers in the future. This research will not only focus on what is in country music, but in many cases, more importantly, what is not there. American country music covers all phases of human experience, or as Mr. Fleischauer said, of American folk life. On the serious side, there's birth, death, marriage, divorce, love gained and lost, etc. And on the humorous side, there is birth, death, marriage, divorce, love gained and lost, etc. Today, we're going to take a look at the political phenomenon that affect all of us. Things like hard times, wars, laws made and broken, inflation, taxes, and so forth. During the period covered, 1924 through 1954, country music generally reflected political or social conditions rather than advocating changes. It reflected public opinion rather than attempting to create it. It is primarily after the period studied that music, especially some rock and some folk music, have been used to bring about social and political changes. It is especially interesting to note that the old songwriters tended to accept hard times and political events as fate, the relief always seemed to be in the by and by, in heaven. Some of the song titles reflecting the conditions which seemed inescapable, at least on earth, are The High Cost of Living, Take Care of the Farmer, 11-cent cotton, 40-cent meat, Dollar Down and a Dollar a Week, and There's a Hard Times Coming, released by Fiddle and John Carson and Moonshine Kate on January 25, 1925. As we know, that hard time did come, and 10 years after Carson's release, in the midst of the Great Depression, A.P. Carter wrote, "No depression in heaven. The words give hope for the end times," by declaring, "For fear the hearts of men are failing, for these are latter days we know." For those of you who have a good memory of the past, there might be somebody here who remembers the gentleman that is sitting up at the front table. He very graciously consented to come up here today, and I'll tell you who he is a little later, but I will give you a clue that he's a recording artist. He is a famous restaurant owner in the Nashville, Tennessee. He's an author. Maybe that's enough. But I got another reference here that I'd like to refer to. He's a former member of the Board of Governors of the National Academy of Recording Arts and Sciences, founder and owner of the Ritz Cafe in Grand Rapids. Can you believe that? In Nashville. Beg pardon?
There is a difference.
Yes, quite a difference. Well, American country music never opposed the 18th Amendment to the United States Constitution, which was passed in 1919. There's a good reason for that, and that's because commercial country music recordings didn't begin until 1924. And at that time, many performers bemoaned the lack of intoxicants in their songs. They did not promote political change, such as the repeal of prohibition, in their songs. Many of the singers, like Ernest Thompson, Riley Puckett, Gid Tanner, Skillet Lickers, and so on, complained about conditions, especially the diligence of the revenuers. The very popular 14-part series, Corn Liquor Still in Georgia, was a story with instrumental interludes of deals made of necessity with the revenuers. And I'd like to mention that on your sheet, it indicates that parts 1 and 2 are being played. Actually, in the full-length recordings that are available of these songs, parts 1 and 2 are there, but we're only going to hear a segment of part 2 where he deals with the revenuers. So if you would, we'll play the segment.
All right, boys, let's fill him up here now. Don't run none of them cans over. Ain't no use to wasting. Come on now, let's rest of you fellas play him a little tune with him.
Stick him up there. We got you covered. Watch that big boy over by the bushes, Tom. He's trying to get away.
Won't be long now.
What are you boys talking around here? Who's running this place?
I'm running myself. Just a minute now.
Where do you live?
I live right over the hill, man.
What kind of a run you got started?
We got about 500 gallons done run off.
I'll have to bust you up and take you down to Gainesville.
It looks like it's some way to get out of this now. He don't taste of it.
No,
it won't hurt you. That's on the best you ever tasted.
Well, that is pretty good liquor. I'll admit that.
That's good liquor. There's some of my boys around here play. He don't taste of it.
Can it settle? Well, that's good liquor.
Right. He'll take another little shot.
I like your little music that you play.
That ain't play good.
Let's have a tune.
All right, boys, come on, play him a little tune. Who's it on up? It's either play or go to jail. Let's go.
Even though country musicians didn't advocate legal changes with regard to prohibition, they did reflect the general mood of the public that beverages were none of the federal government's business. In fact, yesterday on a nationally syndicated program, Alan Stang told the country that today we are told that prohibition ended with repeal. Not quite. Prohibition ended when juries refused to convict. Prohibition was already dead by the time Congress got around to repealing it. Repeal just put an official stamp on what had already happened. The juries killed Prohibition. Congress just buried the corpse. The jury is supreme, not the judge. That's one reason our system is so great. End of the quote. Still, when Prohibition was repealed in 1933 and Franklin Delano Roosevelt reelected in 1936, Bill Cox and Cliff Hobbs gave us a tribute to Roosevelt and the repeal of the 18th Amendment. Let's hear Bill Cox sing part of Franklin D. Roosevelt's Back Again.
Just hand me my old Martin, for soon I will be starting back to dear old Charleston far away.
Hallelujah.
Since Roosevelt's been reelected, we'll not be neglected. We've got Franklin D. Roosevelt back again. Back again. Back again. We've got Franklin D. Roosevelt back again. Been elected, moonshine liquor's been corrected. We've got legal wine, whiskey, beer, and gin. I'll take a drink of brandy and let myself be handy. Good old times are coming back again.
Hallelujah.
You can laugh and tell a joke. You can dance and drink and smoke. We've got Franklin D. Roosevelt back again. Back again. Back again, we've got Franklin D. Roosevelt back again. We'll have money in our jeans, we can travel with the Queen. We've got Franklin D. Roosevelt back again. No more bread lines, we're glad to say, the donkey won election day. No more standing in the blowing snow and rain.
Hallelujah.
We've got things in full sway. We're all working and getting our pay. We've got Franklin D. Roosevelt back again.
It was Franklin Roosevelt who said, "If anything happens in politics, my friends, you can be sure it was planned that way." Which brings us to the most spectacular political activity of all, the planning of wars. Most Americans realize that the ordinary citizens of any country do not plan wars. Wars are planned at the highest diplomatic levels, at the behest of powerful persons outside the halls of government. These insiders benefit by receiving increased power and/or wealth from the waging of wars, and the resulting social upheaval and societal changes brought about by these wars. There is a large field of songs for the researcher on the political and economic consequences of war, but there are virtually no songs written about the causes of war, about why wars are planned, and who benefits from them. Most songs, however, in dealing with war, talk about the personal effects of war, the trials of the soldier, and the hopes and prayers of his loved ones at home. A few songs suggest that God plans wars to punish people for their sins, but more are simple patriotic appeals, extolling the virtues of the homeland and the viciousness of the enemy. The awesome weapons of war also are sometimes the topic of the lyricist, as are the comforts to be gained from faith in God. It might be noted here that there are at least two types of faith in God. One is the blind faith of the uninformed who, knowing that something is wrong, believe that there is nothing they can personally do except pray for deliverance. The other includes those who have learned the lessons of history. These are the people who understand what is happening and why. They follow the biblical command to seek truth in all things, and they seek to be God's hands on earth to do his bidding, to proclaim liberty throughout the land and to all the inhabitants thereof, or to put on the whole armor of God and to know the truth, for the truth shall set you free. For those with no faith in God, there is often a passing faith in nothing greater than themselves, and they tend to suffer whatever fate is held in store for them by those in power. Usually, these aren't very patriotic people because they prefer peace to freedom, often expressing this in a mindless repetition of such slogans as "better red than dead." In the same vein, there are various types of patriotism, ranging from a simple appreciation of the physical and cultural surroundings into which one was born, to a deep commitment to the ideals of the founding fathers, who in their wisdom framed the most limited government on earth, thus paving the way for unprecedented progress materially, as well as fostering a generally high moral standard, which made the American soldier easily discernible from those reared in socialistic and tyrannical regimes. But like any other quality, patriotism too can go awry. For some, the perversion of patriotism occurs through ignorance, giving them the blind desire to follow leaders regardless of whether or not the leaders follow principles. For these, action without knowledge becomes fanaticism, and they may resort to senseless abuse of their adversary, which contributes nothing to furthering the legitimate aims of a free people. Look for various types of patriotism as you listen to some of the popular patriotic songs of the 40s and 50s, such as Remember Pearl Harbor, There's a Star-Spangled Banner Waving Somewhere, Mussolini's Letter to Hitler, Hitler's Reply to Mussolini, We're Gonna Have to Slap That Dirty Little Jap, and I'm No Communist by Lula Bell and Scotty, and the ever-popular song that launched the career of Spike Jonze, Der Fuhrer's Face. I'd like to mention that there is certainly no implication in this talk that there are inferior peoples and superior peoples, and that the Japs are really dirty people. I know that it was popular at the time, but I think we've all gone beyond that point. I would not want to be accused of slanting this talk in favor of the supremacy of white Anglo-Saxon Americans. For now, let's just listen to a short medley to get a sense of the various forms that patriotism can take in song.
She had to rewrite her nursery rhymes. Jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what fun when the Germans run from a great big Russian sleigh. Oh, jingle bells, jingle bells, look at them Russians grin. They're dreaming of a red Christmas marching through Berlin.
There were several things in the songs that I hope you noticed. In the one, Remember Pearl Harbor, they talked about the peace talks and how we were stabbed in the back. And it's been a continuing theme up to the present time that we still want to talk peace all the time. We want to give away our technology to anybody that will take it. And generally, we don't have very strict conditions for repayment. And then I want to call attention to the fact that they did take quite a bit of liberty with those nursery rhymes. Jingle Bells is hardly a nursery rhyme. But at that time, as you noticed from the song, the Russians were the good guys. And since that time, the Russians have been good guys and bad guys, good guys and bad guys. And currently, they're sort of bad guys because of their invasion of Afghanistan and because we want to give our technology to Red China, and we have to have some bad guys to justify that type of gift. So music was reflecting, again, the political reality of the time that Russia, the Russians were the good guys. The American people have purchased large numbers of country songs about the tragedy of war to the individual and to his family. Examples of these popular songs are The Soldier's Last Letter, Robe of White, From Mother's Arms to Korea, Missing in Action, and When a Soldier Knocks and Finds Nobody Home. Here are some samples.
When the postman delivered a letter, it filled her dear heart full of joy. But she didn't know till she read the inside. It was the last one from her darling boy. Dear Mom, was the way that it started. I miss you so much, it went on. Mom, I didn't know that I loved you so, but I'll prove it when this war is won. That night as she knelt by her bedside, she prayed, Lord above, hear my plea, and protect all the sons that are fighting tonight. God keep America free.
If you'll refer to the list of songs that I gave you earlier, there's a prospectus on there, and it's from the Department of State, Foreign Relations of the United States, Soviet Union, 1933 to 39, which is within the period covered. And the last half of the quote in the middle is about the planning of wars. The Soviet Union would certainly attempt to avoid becoming an ally until Japan had been thoroughly defeated and would then merely use the opportunity to acquire Manchuria and Sovietize China. So it was planned, and so it was to be. Of course, this was written a good many years before all of this came about, but that's what planning does. They plan it first, and then it takes place. Songwriters, like the most of us, are affected by propaganda. Stories of the dreadful power of the atomic bomb were with us daily in the late 40s, despite the fact that the conventional bombing of Dresden was more devastating than the atomic bombing of Hiroshima or Nagasaki, even though the residents of Dresden had both warning and basements, while the Japanese cities had neither. Still, the mystery of atomic power was such as to lend itself to the imagination of writers of all kinds, including those who created country music songs. So let us hear a variety of song segments on the weapons theme, and I would mention that the ultimate weapon is in the last song, as recorded by the Leuven brothers. They perceived it to be the ultimate weapon.
that they call a calling card? Are we all in great confusion? Do we know the time or hour? When a terrible explosion may rain down upon our land, leaving horrible destruction, blotting out the works of man.
That a tremble with its strength and mighty power. They're sending us to heaven to get the brimstone fire. Take warning, my dear brother, be careful how you plan. You're working with the mighty power of God's own holy hand. Atomic power, atomic power, was given by the mighty hand of God. Atomic power, it was given by the mighty hand of
Following this initial bomb scare, we learned about the peaceful atom as a wonderful source of energy, which was renamed nuclear energy to distinguish it from the atomic energy released so dramatically in the bomb. This distinction was soon overcome, however, by the pundits and journalists who renamed the bomb nuclear to bring fear and confusion once again into the minds of the general public. Now we are being told that it is better to disarm and live as slaves than to defend to the death, if necessary, our freedom. Once again, it is becoming stylish to think in terms of peaceful coexistence, of peace talks, negotiations, the concept of better red than dead, rather than standing up to perpetuate our American way of life. In many ways, this is a repeat performance of the situation in the early 50s when certain of the, quote, liberal elite, unquote, clustered in cities and around universities to promote disarmament and one world government as the only route to peace, a peace that would always be on a consensus or communist terms, of course. A nation full of hate and full of fear, where a man must whisper so no one will hear, and all those who dared object have quickly died, while an iron curtain keeps the Lord outside. We're going to play the whole song as sung by Jimmy Dickens.
There's a land where little children cannot play, and the people have forgotten how to pray. It's a land where faith and friendship should be tried, but an iron curtain keeps the Lord outside. They lock God outside the iron curtain, although Satan may have placed the kingly crown. But this evil nation will never find salvation till the Lord tears the iron curtain down.
I was wrong. We didn't hear the whole song. We've got to coordinate the text and the music, and it's my fault. Alan has done a great job. At this point, I'd like to, for those who have been curious, is there anybody who recognizes our guest?
Okay.
Well, here is the Monument album that he put out, and this is about 20 years old. This is a picture of our guest at that time, if any of you can see it. He also has two albums on Warner Brothers. He's the author of a book called The Miracle on Main Street. Okay, well, I hope he's not disappointed that nobody recognizes him. And a reason I say that is last night is the first time that he knew I was coming to this conference, and he never heard of ARSC either. So I felt terrible about it. But he's got the whole full background on ARCs now, and perhaps he'll get involved with us. The book that he wrote is called The Miracle on Main Street, and we have it here. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about that before this next song. The words to this final number were written by Scotty Wiseman more than 30 years ago. The title is I'm No Communist. The writer had a deep understanding of where we were heading. He understood the national debt and how inflation could destroy our country if it wasn't stopped. As we well know, all restraints on the printing of irredeemable unbacked paper currency have been lifted. In other words, the government has issued itself a license to counterfeit. What most of us don't realize is that Article 1, Section 10 of the United States Constitution is still in full force, having never been amended or repealed. It has, however, been ignored both by the general public and more especially by the public officials who are supposed to live by it. By that section of the Constitution, our founding fathers outlawed paper money, presumably forever in our land. But by the time Scotty was writing his famous song, inflation caused by paper currency was well underway, though nowhere near the proportions that we are seeing today. How could this happen? Well, we know that paper money first appeared in our constitutional republic at the time of the Civil War. And we know that inflation has been a regular camp follower in all the more recent years, so it doesn't take too much figuring to arrive at the conclusion that the financial pressures of war influence people in government to expand the currency, thus reducing the value of all money in circulation, systematically robbing everyone in the process. The first foray into counterfeiting, which occurred during the Civil War, was corrected by Congress in 1870 when they once again outlawed paper money and restored the Constitution to effect. America prospered for the next 30 years until paper was reintroduced. The fascinating story of this is in a book written by another well-known songwriter, F. Tupper Saucy of Sewanee, Tennessee. The book is called The Miracle on Main Street. It was written not just to appraise us of another problem, but to equip us with a solution to the root problem of most of the evils that we face today. I would like to mention, too, that he's had many of his songs recorded by country artists. Some of the artists that did record them were Brenda Lee, Chet Atkins, Ray Stevens, Don Everly, and then others were Connie Smith, Don Perry Como, and Patti Page. So he comes as, I would say, a master in that which he touches. The book is in its sixth printing, well over 100,000 copies. And if I should say to you that those friends of paper money that control things today wouldn't want you to read it, that's the truth, because there has been no promotion of the book other than the people themselves. Those who read it wish to distribute it and get it to additional people. I think I can safely say that having sold 2,500 copies of that book myself, that each copy has had at least two readers. I know of copies that have had 15 people read it, and they take it to public officials, judges, magistrates, etc., and have them sign it when they read it. And they're excited. They like this information. It is not taught in the schools. So if you will, refer to the back of the list that you received for reference on the program. You will see that the complete words of the song "I'm No Communist" by Scotty Wiseman are there. And hopefully I didn't make a mistake. I intended that the whole song be on the tape.
We're living in a country that's the finest place on earth. But some folks don't appreciate this land that gave them birth. I hear that up in Washington they're having an awful fuss. Plus communists and spies were making monkeys out of us. The bureaus and departments have been busy night and day. They're figuring out just how we gave our secrets all away. And Congress has appointed a committee, so they said, to find out who's American and who's a low-down red. They call them up to Washington to speak for Uncle Sam. But when they ask them what they are, they shut up like a clam. I wish they'd take and put me on the witness stand today. I'd yell so loud old Stalin could hear me all the way.
I'm no communist, I'll tell you that right now. I believe a man should own his own house and far and foul.
I like this private ownership, I want to be left alone.
Let the government run its business and let me run my own.
Our government is bigger than it ever was today. The more they hire to work for it, the more they have to pay. Our public servants should be proud and honest, you would think, instead of taking bribes and dressing up their wives in mink. The taxes keep on going up, of that there is no doubt. But still they just can't take it in as fast as they dish it out. Our national debt is a monster size and growing every day. Our children's children still unborn are gonna have to pay. Our dollar used to be the soundest money on this earth. But now $2 won't even buy a good old dollar's worth. Unless we stop inflation and take care of what we've got, the communists may win the fight and never fire a shot.
I'm no communist, I'll tell you that right now. I believe a man should own his own house and car and cow.
I like this private ownership, I want to be left alone.
Let the government run its business and let me run my own.
Well, I hope you feel that I've kept my word. I've been discussing politics and religion so far. And I hope we really can still remain friends. And I plan to have time for questions, so if you have something in mind, please make a note of it and we'll try to get to a few questions. But first, I would like to give you some information sheets about these powerful insiders that I've discussed who have really controlled and staffed the administrations of both political parties in this country for more than 50 years. And if any group controlled both parties for 50 years and we didn't know about it, that would become significant information, and our country's songs do not include this information. But these insiders have been clustered into two groups, and they both have the chairman. The name is David Rockefeller. He's the chairman of the Council on Foreign Relations, known as the CFR, and the Trilateral Commission. It's an international group often referred to as the TC. President Carter had 284 members of these groups in the policy spots, the key spots of his administration. President Reagan has over 300, the most of any president in history. Their primary interest is in controlling money and foreign policy to create what they call a new world order, which will also control the means of production and distribution of all goods throughout the world. And I'm sure that would raise some questions in some minds. There is only one artist in modern times and two of his songs which allude to this. Merle Haggard has done two songs, one called I Wish a Buck Was Still Silver, and he gives the reasons, and Big City, which also touches the fundamental problem related to money. All of this about Tupper in the book was written before I had talked to him, so he didn't plan on this. I called him last night after we arrived. We do have the book here, and it's a $7 book that I'm going to make available for $5 if anybody wants it, and Tupper can autograph it. You kind of have to take my word for it that the book is terrific. But many people have come back to me and said it's the best book they ever read in their life, and it's certainly one of the two best I've ever read in my life. So I hope that you will not mistake Tupper for Scotty Wiseman, who did the song I'm No Communist. He may look a little like that, but Scotty is not with us today. I'd like to conclude my talk formally by stating that all this research has shown that while American country music laments government interference in our lives, it has not identified this government meddling as the primary cause of our social problems. Neither has it attempted to influence governmental activity. It's merely served as a reflection of various segments of public opinions. Our country songs simply reflect the conditions with which the individual must deal, and generally they offer no solution, or only the heavenly solution arrived at through death and or God's intervention. There is some evidence that this is changing. We at this conference can become a force for the truth by informing ourselves and others. It is lack of knowledge that leads people into captivity. Our music reflects love of our country. Let's put a firm foundation of knowledge behind that love. It is only by remaining free that we will enjoy many more wonderful ARSC conferences. Thank you for your attention.
If there are any discographical questions for Jack Harper, we'll welcome them at this point. As for the additional materials that were announced, we're not going to pass them out in here. We don't really think of that as an ARSC function, but if you'd like to speak to him or his wife outside afterward, they have them and they'll be glad to hand them out to you. Are there any questions for Mr. Harper on this paper?
I was just wondering if there are any clear effects of the blacklisting of the 50s on the music of country music, particularly whether any performers were blacklisted, whether records were cut but not released, and it would seem to me that that is another aspect of the politics.
That is another aspect of the research, Mr. Seeker, and I didn't get into that field. I have some materials on the blacklisting, but it didn't. Time is always a problem. When you do a research project like this, even though you have an hour, there are many weeks and sometimes months or years of preparation for that 1 hour. And if it's a half hour, there's even more preparation. It's harder yet. The shorter the talk, the more difficult in doing it. But it's a good point, and I'm glad you brought it up. There was certainly blacklisting. Go ahead. Would you like to come up to the microphone? And if you would, for the record, state your name.
Melvin Priestead. I think one person that was blacklisted was Pete Seeger.
That's right.
He didn't sign that communist thing, which that song, I Was No Communist, is really about. People that wouldn't sign that, state that they were not, they didn't want to put it on paper that they were not communists, whether they were or not.
That's right. And that's good.
I have a country music program in Milwaukee, and listen to your songs there. You only played two that I haven't played, and if you wasn't that you live so far from Milwaukee, I would have thought you were listening to my program.
Wow, that's terrific. Thank you. I appreciate that. Any other questions?
I'm Marie Griffin. I'm from the Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers. And I'm wondering if some of these songs not only reflected but affected public policy to a large degree. What a lot of people heard often would be affecting the way they thought about things. Would you comment on that?
Yes. Well, for example, the song I'm No Communist came after public opinion was already there of people not wanting to be identified as communists. They were afraid to be identified as communists. So Grandpa Jones also made this recording about the same time, as did Louvabel and Scotty. Scotty Wiseman wrote the song. So I think that if you study the time period, you will find that after public opinion was formed, then the country music writers wrote the song. They wanted them to be popular, and they wouldn't write a song at that time anyway that they didn't think would sell. And they thought there was enough people in this country that wanted to say, I'm no communist, so they did put the song out. But I couldn't find any attempt to actually tell people what they ought to believe, whether it's prohibition, inflation, war, or anything else. Let's say we were anti-Nazi and anti-Japanese against the Axis. Well, the songs reflected that, and they reflected the concepts that came out of Washington. Okay, any other questions? Okay, well, thank you. Oh, I have a lot of material. If you do have private questions that you want to ask, I'm in room 818, and I have a lot of material to substantiate the remarks, like that the bombing of Dresden was more damaging, 250,000 deaths, which was more than in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Anything that I've said, we do have the material. Also, I've got a study on rock and roll music as a pre-revolutionary form of cultural subversion with the words of the songs in here. And that isn't all rock and roll. You know, it isn't all folk or anything else. It's just certain artists tried to bring about change after this period we studied. Hey, no more questions? Well, thank you very much, and I hope everyone has a nice lunch.